Are you one of the millions of North Americans with irritable bowel syndrome, or do you have something weird going on with your gut that you're trying to figure out? Then you probably want to listen to today's episode because we are talking all about IBS with dietitian Jessie Wong. Hello, friends. My name is Desiree Nielsen, and you are listening to the All Sorts podcast, where we make wellness not suck. I started this podcast because I wanted to create a space where you could access evidence-based, positive, and actually useful information about taking care of yourself. I choose my guests so carefully because I don't want to add to the confusion that so many of us feel around wellness, particularly because after just 30 seconds on the internet, you might be told to go vegan or eat nothing but meat, or wind up confused about what you even can eat because you just heard about 7 different foods that are supposed to be quote unquote inflammatory. And today's episode on IBS is an important one, because there is still so much misinformation around the condition. And as a gut health dietitian, but also as someone who lives with IBS, I want you to be armed with the best possible information you can in order to better manage your symptoms alongside your care team. So I've asked Jessie Wong, an IBS dietitian based in Seattle, to give us the IBS 101, what it is, how it's diagnosed, what other conditions can masquerade as IBS, as well as detailed, practical advice on what you need to do before you see your doc, and even the underlying causes of symptoms of IBS, and how to know what nutrition approach is right for you, because it's not always low FODMAP. This episode is jam-packed with information, so keep that notes tab handy and let's dive in. Hi, Jessie. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us on the All Sorts podcast.
Hi, Desiree. Such an honor to be on here. And yeah.
I love talking to fellow like IBS dietitians. It's, you know, there's so many more of us now than there used to be, but like, I still feel like we're like a rarefied bunch. And I feel like all of us also have IBS. Like, I feel like pretty much like every dietitian who goes into IBS is like, I got IBS. And I was like, why can I not find the care that I want? Like,
Yeah, absolutely. If we don't have the poop issue, we won't become a poop dietitian, right? And then we probably, I'm assuming most of us have tried everything else before we finally figure it out and really following the evidence on what's going on and how do we do things.
Yeah, but you didn't start out as a dietitian. This is like a second career for you. What did you do before you became a dietitian?
No, I was a public accountant. So I would say it's not the most exciting job, you know, because you're dealing with numbers, spreadsheets all day long for a long time every single day. And it's good income, it's good business, and it's necessary. You always have a job, is how I got into it. I'm like, but after a few years in that industry, I think I was just done with it. It wasn't something I wanted to do. And there's no joy in doing the work I did, even though it paid well. You don't sleep very well. You don't sleep very much, let's put it that way. And then, of course, eventually, you know, I also see older colleagues like start having issues with their health as well, because it's just difficult to take care of yourself when you're under so much stress all the time, when you're not sleeping and not eating well. And I really wanted to do something that I can be helping people. Mm-hmm. I'm connecting with people. I'm helping with people. I think that's where I really enjoy. And I did not know there is a thing as a dietitian before, but one of my middle school friends actually became a dietitian in Australia. And I asked her, what is this? What do you do? And she shared with me a bunch of things about nutrition and dietitians. And I was like, well, I think this is something I enjoy doing. And of course, we think about being a dietitian and we think about helping people eat healthy. But what we really do now, I mean, especially in the GI field, we probably help people to eat more food than they think they can, right? And speaking against diet culture or even just, you know, helping people reintroduce food back into their diets. So yeah, I went back to school for 5 years and then became credentialed. Lucky I could do that. Had 2 kids meanwhile. And that, trying to multitask, you know, as a mom, as a woman. So we always do that. And now I'm a dietitian, and IBS happened in our family. It actually started with my husband, and he was diagnosed. It's really funny. He was a PhD candidate at a college, and he went to the student clinic there and told the doctor all about his symptoms. And the doctor Googled in front of him and was like, oh, you sound like you have IBS. Here you go. There's a diagnosis. We'll see you soon. Bye. And it's just funny how sometimes, like back in the days, right, there's not a whole lot of research or education on IBS. There's no standardized recommendation on what you're supposed to do. And he really struggled with it for a long time, like a long, long time. He still has some sensitivity right now, but mostly, you know, if we resolve the constipation, he's good to go. And making those little lifestyle changes to improve motility, you know, that's where the magic happens. But that's not what people want to hear. And we've tried so many things. We've done all the tests out there. We've tried so many things. I had supplements, you know. Those expensive supplements that you have to get behind a pharmacy counter where they store it in the fridge, you know, those things, I wasted a ton of money on those things. We didn't go the alternative route, which thankfully we did not, because that could be, you know, endless amounts of money we're talking about here and extreme restriction from diet. But yeah, it started with him and got to me because we started doing low FODMAP back in the days. Again, you know, you have this low FODMAP good and bad list. And then we just like, let's do low FODMAP. It's the food that's causing all the bloating and the symptoms. When it again really wasn't, it was a gut motility issue that we need to work on, but we didn't know. And I started having IBS myself during my second pregnancy. So when you're pregnant, you're more likely to have chronic constipation anyways. And that burdens, I think, combined, coupled with being on low FODMAP for so long. And that just wasn't a good combination. And once you have chronic constipation, it's just so much more that you have to manage to make sure you're going every day, or else it comes back quickly. And I went to our doctor, and of course we did all the tests for me too. Celiac, H. pylori. I was like, it's something my husband had. He has the same symptoms, and now I have it too. I'm pretty sure it's H. pylori. I was like, we have to test it. We did the breath test. We did the stool test. And they all came back negative. And I was like, okay, fine. And it's like, you probably, well, we did celiac as well. We did a colonoscopy as well. And so you probably have IBS now. I'm sorry about that, but you know, we call it pregnancy-induced IBS, and that's what you have. I was like, all right. Yeah, and thankfully I'm a dietitian. So that's when we really dived into the evidence and start working on our diet and lifestyle and reintroducing all the food that we have cut out, because we thought, you know, they were the evil things that were causing us to have the symptoms, when, you know, they really are not that evil, but we need to work on other things, the little things in life that matters.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So I also got IBS after having my first child. And we have very little data about this in the literature, right? Like post-infectious IBS. But I mean, it's not uncommon to hear. And I'd be so curious to see more science emerge in this area, but I want to, and we're gonna get back into the nitty-gritty of like, what is IBS and all that kind of stuff. But I want to pick on something that you said, because I think it's so profound, in that you as a gut health dietitian are often helping people reintroduce foods and expand their diets again, because so many people, I'm sure for you and also like in our practice, people come to us on these very, very restrictive diets, thinking that it's always food as the enemy causing their symptoms, which 100% I understand, because if you eat and then you get symptoms, your first thought is, what did I eat that caused those symptoms, as opposed to what's going on in my body that made me have symptoms because I'm eating. So what do you see in practice? What was your experience with yourself after being low FODMAP that long? What was that like to say, hey, maybe this isn't exactly the foods? Like, how do you start to broach this idea or convince your clients, I think we might be a little too restricted here. We need to start expanding again.
Right. I mean, I think for us, thankfully, Monash came up with the dietitian training. It's like, okay, let's do the training. Let's see what this is all really about, and reintroduce one food at a time, right? So that we know our actual tolerance. We didn't have any food intolerance. My husband maybe a little bit more than I do, but we mostly can eat everything. And when it comes to the clients we work with, and I think a lot of them come to us with some form of disordered eating, they're already restricting for food for a long time, or they're very afraid of food. I don't want to label them as eating disorder because their angle of working with us is also want to reintroduce food, identify triggers if they have any. Or the level of tolerance when we are reintroducing FODMAPs, because we do it, as a dietitian, we do the gradual reintroduction of FODMAPs and monitoring symptoms and really give them the confidence knowing how much they can eat without having symptoms. Or when symptoms do come back, what do you do to take care of the symptoms? And it's especially important for people with chronic constipation. It is okay to eat maybe, say, fructans, right? Fructans do cause more gas and may cause some slower gut motility for others. But what else can you do to help improve your motility when you're eating a trigger food? Like, those are the things that we really help our clients manage, like learn, like here are some tools for you to use. And here is your level of tolerance when eating these kind of foods. So don't be afraid of it. Just go ahead and slowly reintroduce them and eat them more consistently. And I think a lot of the times, people who have eliminated certain foods for prolonged periods, their tolerance is not going to be that great when we reintroduce it. And having patience and in the reintroduction process is so important, because most of the time they might be only able to eat a small amount to start, but eventually in a few months they can eat more of a medium serve or a full serve once they really rebuild their gut microbiome into breaking down those food. And that's where people, I think, don't understand for the most part when they're cutting out food, right? They're really focusing on the elimination process, but not knowing how to reintroduce. Or they know they need to reintroduce, but they don't know how, and they dump their system with a bunch of those food, and then symptom explodes, and that creates so much more fear than when they were eliminating it. So yeah, that's in a nutshell what we do.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting because I think the prevailing thought when you listen to people on the internet, when you're on social media, is that we all have these food intolerances causing issues, and restriction is the solution to intolerance. Whereas more often than not, restriction is breeding intolerance. And so, you know, if someone restricts food for so long, and then, yeah, like you said, they just put this huge load back, they get the symptoms, and that becomes this confirmation, oh, right, my issues were because of this food intolerance, because they don't think, oh, I've lost my tolerance and it can be rebuilt again. I think that's like a really powerful mindset shift when thinking mm-hmm. about the interplay between your diet and your symptoms.
Yeah, definitely. And do so confidently, right? Test, don't guess.
Yes, I love that. Okay, maybe we need to go all the way back now, because, you know, we should talk about what IBS is and what causes it. So what is irritable bowel syndrome?
So it's kind of interesting the way it is categorized nowadays. So it's considered a disorder of gut-brain interaction. And what is gut-brain interaction, right? And gut-brain interaction is a group of disorders classified by GI symptoms related to, I'm going to list them out because it's interesting, because you don't think about them as these kind of symptoms, like motility disturbance, visceral hypersensitivity, altered mucosa and immunofunction, altered gut microbiota, and altered central nervous system processing. Which a lot of the times what I say to people is that your gut and your brain are not communicating at the right pace. And then because of that, it may cause motility issue. Food is moving too fast or too slow through your system. Or you are feeling, for example, gas in your system as perceived pain or perceived pressure inside. And then, but of course, there are people with some real actual symptoms like sharp pain or gas and bloating. I know bloating is a perceived thing. It's not everybody has a different feeling when there's gas moving around. But for people with IBS or with a disorder of gut-brain interaction, they may feel it more intensely because of the visceral hypersensitivity. IBS, even though it's more so an irritable bowel symptom, or we think it relates to poop, which it does relate to poop, but more so is your nervous system having a disconnection. But that's the more technical or more the scientific understanding of IBS. And of course, for those of us who work in the IBS field, we also know that IBS is a melting pot of diagnoses that often gets thrown into IBS because everything else came back negative. And most of the time, people get tested for celiac and inflammatory bowel disease and maybe H. pylori, and maybe they do scopes as well. But then there are other conditions that often get mixed into with IBS, such as bile acid diarrhea, non-celiac wheat sensitivity. What else? SIBO is another one. And then I'm trying to think, but yeah, there are other conditions. Yeah. Oh, pancreatic insufficiency is another one that is common. It's difficult to test for, but then it's easily treatable with medications.
Yeah. And endometriosis is another one that wasn't really on my radar until, unfortunately, relatively recently, because it's another one of those conditions that is often underdiagnosed. Symptoms are written off because this, you know, it happens to menstruating adults. And that inflammation can also present like IBS because the uterus is so close, like literally just jammed up there with a digestive tract.
Yes.
And so something that you said is really important to highlight, that if you are going to the doctor with these symptoms, they should not just be saying, oh, sounds like IBS, and sending you off and calling it a day. They should actually be testing for other things, right?
Yes. So they need to be testing for celiac, for inflammatory bowel disease. And these are blood tests you can do and also fecal tests and scopes to rule out certain inflammatory bowel disease and celiac too. So celiac would be endoscopy, colonoscopy for inflammatory bowel disease. So they need to at least rule out these two things to make sure you don't have those. And then look into other conditions, depending on what symptoms you have, do you have, and what type of IBS it could be. There's constipation, there's mixed bowel type, and there's diarrhea. And most of the time, there's one symptom that really bothers everyone, and that is bloating. I think it's really important for us to educate patients and maybe even physicians about different types of bloating as well, because that can help us identify, you know, or help us determine what tests we want to get. Is it related to upper GI? Is it more so lower GI? You know, for your listeners, if you have a pen and paper, here is where you want to write down what you want to document regarding your bloat. You know, there are many different types of bloating. So first thing is your bloat upper GI or lower GI? Is it above the belly button or below the belly button? Do you wake up bloated? Do you bloat after eating? How long does your bloating last? Does the bloating correlate to your bowel movements? You know, do you bloat less on the days when you have full evacuations? So does it bloat more on the days when you have better evacuations or maybe you are having a flare? You know, is there any specific food that triggers your bloating, right? Because some people do have a food intolerance. You know, you want to document all of these before you go to your doctor. And you probably want to document your bowel movements as well. Take some pictures. Don't be shy. We love looking at your poop so we can see what is going on, what type of bowel movements you have. And that can really help us identify, you know, what may be causing the symptoms. I was going to say, I'll give an example of IBS constipation because I think a lot of us, well, a lot of people who come to me will say, Jesse, I have a bowel movement every single day. I'm fine. I'm not constipated. I'm just constantly bloated and I'm so painful all the time. And then when you look at their pictures of the bowel movements, like, yeah, they look good. They look like type 2 or type 3 and that's it. Once a day. It's not a full evacuation. So the residual stools is going to stay in the colon and they're going to be fermented. They're going to cause gas and the trapped gas is going to cause a lot of pain. So those are all important things, right? We want to document, we want to share with our physicians, hopefully a physician who understands these things and can really guide you through what to do next or help you identify what is going on and order the right test for you to rule out other conditions before giving you an IBS diagnosis.
I love that so much, particularly for people listening. It can be so difficult when you're going to the physician first because there is so much stigma around this. You know, people will always, when I see them one-on-one, they'll apologize. I'm like, I'm sorry, this is gross. And I was like, no, this isn't gross. This is our bodies. You know, like if you were talking to your doctor or your digestive dietitian, we don't think it's gross. Like this is just our body. So like we need to be brave enough to say, this is actually what's going on. Like take the picture. You actually started something called poopedia.org. Can you tell us about, because this relates to the poo pictures.
Yes, yes. So of course, being a GI dietitian and looking at patients' poop pictures, I think all of us might have been in a phase where we want to look for more resources to educate ourselves on different stool types. What do they really look like in real life? Because nothing looks like what the Bristol stool chart has. It's very standardized, like, yep, that's it. You know, these are the characteristics to look for. But in reality, stools don't look like that all the time. And there's variations of type 1, type 2, type 3, and even type 4 stools. So I think I was pretty frustrated, like there's no such resources out there. And one of the things we do with our clients is really looking at what they're eating, what their symptoms are, and how it affects their bowel movements. Right. And so I have this reservoir of stool pictures from our clients. And one day I thought, well, it would be really great if we have these resources out there for practitioners or for patients themselves so that they can look up and see what type of stool they have. And it would help them in terms of documenting their symptoms as well. If you want to be documenting your poop for your doctor, you need to know what type you're documenting, right? Taking the picture is helpful, but the consistently taking pictures every day and writing down, you know, what type of stool I have today, what is the volume, you know, not just the type, you want to write about the volume as well. It's just hard to know what type of stool you actually have. Is it between a 3 and a 4? Yeah, more likely than not, it's between a 3 and a 4, or maybe between a 2 and a 3. It's never just like, it's this, it's that. So we put together the pictures of, we got consent from our client and then put some of their pictures up onto poopedia.org. And on that website, you will learn about the Bristol stool chart so that you know how to classify it, type 1 to type 7 of stool. And when you click into each type, you can see real pictures, real stool pictures from people who have those stools. So you can kind of identify and look up yours to see what kind of stool you have and document it that way.
I love that. That's so helpful. So to get people really prepared, because sometimes IBS is not. I think now GPs have so much more awareness about it. But if you come in going, okay, so here's my bloating. It's below the belly button. It's happening at these times. I think it's happening with these foods. So here are my poops. They're like a 6 because I looked on, you know, I looked on your resource. To go in armed with that information helps your physician so much to make a correct diagnosis. And that's so important to make sure that you get the help you need as opposed to them going, oh, you know, like it's not celiac disease. Your tests are all clear. I don't know. Maybe you're fine. Maybe it's quote unquote all in your head. And then you walk away frustrated because you don't get the care that you need.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that documentation part is really important. And I'm sure us being dietitians in this field, we know a lot of the times we ask our patients questions and they come in, they don't know. It's like there are different types of bloating. I don't know what bloats I have. I don't know when I bloat. But if you can document all of these prior to your appointments, it's going to be so helpful for us to maybe identify what is going on and recommend certain tests, or your doctor may order certain tests to rule out certain conditions before giving you an IBS diagnosis. And with IBS, you have to consistently have the symptoms for 3 to 6 months before you can get an IBS diagnosis.
Yeah. And that's important for people. You know, there's always this fine line in digestive health. I feel that on one hand, you know, you have the wellness folks, you know, in quotation marks, and they're like, oh, if you're bloated, it means you have a food intolerance. It's like, no, I maybe just had a really big dinner. Like sometimes we get bloated. Sometimes we get constipated. If we're going on a long overseas flight, we're probably going to be constipated for a day or two. There is normal variation in digestion. But then on the opposite spectrum, you know, we see so many clients who have had these symptoms for a year, for 2 years, and they haven't done anything, sometimes 5 years, and they haven't done anything about it until now. So I see this like, you know, all bloating is not bad. Sometimes it's just a big meal. Versus if you have this experience daily, you've got to trust your instinct, like trust your gut, right? Like go see your doctor, right. Go see the dietitian. I want to talk a little bit also about, you know, when we know sort of what's going on in IBS, the bloating, the pain, the motility issues, what do we know about what's actually causing it?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And it's sometimes it's really the gut-brain interaction causing it. Our brain, our gut's being hypersensitive, and our brain pick up on the signal and telling us that it has these things passing through. There's some spasm going on, which could be normal spasms, but you are sensing it a lot more. So sometimes it can be the gut-brain reaction, right? And sometimes some people do have food intolerance. That can be causing some of the pain, especially some intense spasms. Well, if you're curious about this, there is a blog post on food intolerance on poopedia.org for you to check out. Because when we work with people with real food intolerances, they still look different. It's very thin, and I call them spasmodic stools or spasming stools because they are just not normal. But so that's one another type. And then, of course, there are people with dysbiosis, with SIBO, with or just colonic microbiome dysbiosis, where they have a lot more bloating than others, and that causes a lot of pain. But of course, the most common kind that causes symptoms is chronic constipation and trapped gas. If you have stool fermenting in your colon and they are trapped in there, the gas is really expanding in your colon. That causes a lot of pain and oftentimes sharp pain as well. Or dull pain if you're really constipated because the whole colon would be full. And we know that because a lot of our clients also do x-rays or CT scans where we can see the stool burden in there and the significant gas buildup inside. And what they usually say is, after they have better evacuations, we do encourage laxative initially because it's so helpful to get everything clean out. And after they use the laxative, they feel much better. But sometimes they also feel the pain when everything finally empties out because their colon is contracting a bit more hypersensitive after all the stool comes out.
This is a really important point to highlight because I think there is, and I think it's easy to mistake this because as dietitians, we'll always talk about constipation is very, very common in North America. Few of us consume enough fiber. So many of us are counseling all the time. Eat more fiber to make sure you make good poops. But when you have chronic constipation or IBS constipation, you can't just throw more fiber on it. That's actually a bad thing. Can you clarify why throwing a bunch of fiber on IBS-C is so bad?
Yes. And of course, like, again, we see a lot of x-rays and CT scans where people's colon is full of stool. And when you are so full of stool and you try to throw more fiber to force things to come out, that's just gonna, I hate to use this word, but we hear it from patients all the time. It's going to kill your gut because there's no space for things to go. And that's when we see a lot of people vomiting or having really significant reflux as well, because they're just so backed up to a point. And when it comes to improving gut motility, right, fiber is so important, but it's absolutely not the first step. The first step is empty things out and then increase fiber slowly, gradually, as you can tolerate it. So you don't throw your gut into shock. I guess, you know, shock is the right word, right? Your gut goes into such shock. It's already suffering. It's already having so much burden. And then you shock it with a ton more fiber. And sometimes it can't send somebody into diarrhea right away, which can be helpful, right? You finally have relief. But other times it just makes a person more blocked out. And potentially, and a lot of the times we hear is people go to the ER. And in the ER, what they end up doing is really giving you a lot of laxative to help you clean out. Yeah. But and with motility, I'm going to talk a little bit about this because this is something we do all the time. And I'm sure you know, is making those tiny lifestyle changes that really is important, right? Hydration, you know, make sure you're well hydrated. I think there was one thing I heard a while ago. I'm not sure if it's still true, right? Americans or maybe North Americans, we are chronically dehydrated and we are stuffed all the time. And I think for most of us, it may be true on some days, but there are definitely people who can improve on it. And there is a diet trend on drinking a ton of fluids, but let's exclude those people. But hydration is important, right? Fiber intake is important, but go slow. Go very slow to what you can tolerate. And then we don't think about sleep. Are you getting enough sleep? Because that can affect your gut motility and that can affect your gut microbiome diversity as well. Stress can slow down the gut significantly or speed up the guts depending on the person. And then meal timing. Oh, this can be a big one because I think what I find a lot is people don't eat breakfast and they're really missing the window of opportunity to poop. Because breakfast is when you experience gastrocolic reflux the most or the strongest time. And that is when we eat food into our stomach, that sends a signal to our colon to say, hey, it's time to go to the bathroom. Let's empty things out because there's food coming. And that sensation is the strongest in the morning. If you skip breakfast, you are skipping your golden window of poop, the golden poop window. Yes.
Well, and I see that, you know, because I'm on the IBSD side myself, and I think the vast majority of our clients have IBSD, and skipping breakfast often becomes a tool for exactly that reason. Because if they're going 3-4 times in the morning, they may recognize that if they don't eat breakfast, it might be a little gentler. But I always caution against that. So it's like, how can we create a very tolerated breakfast, like something that's going to be gentle on the stomach? So you still give that input to your digestive tract without, you know, say, throwing a ton of fiber on the system that's just going to like really barrel things through. So it's like, if you've been using skipping breakfast as a coping mechanism, it's important to consider that in the long run, it's not a good idea.
Yes, absolutely. And actually, in our clinic, we see that between C and D, both type, because when they're so constipated and they eat, they bloat right away and they can't function throughout the day. So they just not eat and then end up pinging later on at night. And that goes into a bad cycle, which is really difficult to break. But yes, a gentle breakfast. That's a great reminder for everybody else out there. Don't shock your system. Eat something easy to digest.
Yeah, I love me a low FODMAP smoothie for exactly that reason. Okay, we've already sort of slid into nutrition. So let's get into it because I think now, I mean, 15 years ago when I was starting as a dietitian, low FODMAP was considered controversial. I had other dietitians saying, there's no evidence for that. How can you be, you know, counseling on the low FODMAP diet? And here we are all this later, and it's as close to gold standard as we have, but it's not for everyone, which we'll also talk about. So let's start with, what is this low FODMAP diet thing that people talk about for IBS?
Right. So low FODMAP helps about 50 to 80% of IBS patients. It's not 100%. Some people respond to it better than others. But low FODMAP basically means certain fermentable carbohydrates, they're short-chain carbohydrates that our body don't digest, don't absorb, but our gut microbes will break them down. And that can cause more gas in people or more symptoms. And some of the short-chain carbohydrates actually draws water or fluids into our intestines. And that can cause different sets of symptoms as well, like diarrhea or more so urgency side of things. Now, all of them are fermentable, so they cause gas. They cause changing that motility. And which is why when we reduce our FODMAP intake, we tend to feel better for people with gut symptoms, not for normal people, right? But the goal here with the low FODMAP diet is not to restrict them forever. It really is to eliminate and then reintroduce one group of FODMAPs at a time to identify, you know, what we tolerate, what we don't tolerate, and what our level of tolerance is for those groups so that we can personalize a diet moving forward. And I think with the low FODMAP diet, it is the gold standard now. And there's still controversy, right, about how long we should be on the diet for. Traditionally speaking, we are thinking 2 to 6 weeks if you're working with a dietitian. But now there are more studies that are coming out saying that longer term restriction is okay. It can potentially reduce inflammation as well. And I think for anybody listening here, if you are doing a longer term elimination, make sure you're working with a dietitian on this. Because while you are eliminating FODMAPs, we still want to ensure variety in your diet. You're still eating the rainbow, eating all the available FODMAP foods that you can incorporate into your diet, into your day. And I think it's easier said than done. Most people think that we can do it ourselves, but then they end up eating 5 to 10 foods because they don't know how to incorporate more foods into your diet, or their day is just so hectic that they have a meal prep and then they don't have a low FODMAP option and they end up skipping a breakfast or a lunch and just eat everything at dinner. So working with a dietitian is going to be really helpful in implementing the low FODMAP phase. And then also with dietitian will help you challenge it or reintroduce it group by group. So you really learn your tolerance level and then expand your diet based on what you tolerate.
So important too, because I do believe that most people are like, okay, well, here's the diet. I can just follow the diet. But we realize that the low FODMAP diet is symptom management. Like we're trying to calm mm-hmm. the bowel down and improve symptoms. But nutrition still has another layer, which is to nourish you. So if right. you are cutting out these foods, we need to make sure you're getting your minerals. We need to make sure you're still introducing fiber into the system and the variety in the system. And so we don't want you 4 weeks from now or 8 weeks from now starving all the time or having low energy. And that's why you work with mm-hmm. a dietitian, even though, yes, there are a million websites, there's a million books where you can learn what the low FODMAP diet is about, but it is those little tweaks to make sure you're happy, you're healthy, you're full, you are enjoying what you're eating alongside all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Not just the restriction. And so many of our clients have bought books themselves, have tried it themselves, but not able to reintroduce the food. And sometimes it's the little things that we need to improve, right? If you have a gut motility issue and you don't resolve it and you try to reintroduce FODMAPs, it's not going to work. You're going to blow up because it's going to be stuck in your colon. It's going to ferment. So let's work on the gut motility first before you reintroduce the food.
Now, I want to sort of flip something you said about the low FODMAP diet early, because I typically say that as well, that it works for between 50 and 80% of people. And people will hear that and go, wow, that's awesome. Okay, great. But when you flip it and say it doesn't work for between 20 and 50% of people, it doesn't, and people are like, oh, okay, because I think when people try it and they expect it to work and realize sometimes it doesn't, but also it's not right for everyone. Can you talk a little bit about maybe who should not consider a low FODMAP diet, even if they have IBS?
Yeah, so for anyone who have an active eating disorder or anyone who's really afraid of food in general, so it may not be a full-blown eating disorder, or you're already really afraid of food, you know, if we are, then we don't want to be adding an extra layer of restriction onto their already limited diet. So that's something as a dietitian we need to assess first before we recommend a low FODMAP diet. There is another way to approach this is the FODMAP gentle approach, where we don't go full-blown low FODMAP. We limit certain high FODMAP foods, but we still eat normal. And I think that actually works the best for most people because, well, first you need to resolve whatever is going on, right? Whatever is triggering your diarrhea, whatever is causing constipation. Well, with constipation, you know, manage it with some help of laxative and also other things that you need to work on a day-to-day basis. And sometimes, you know, with some of my clients, I know FODMAP is not their trigger. And being low FODMAP or even being FODMAP gentle is hard for them. As long as their symptoms are well managed, it's okay that they stay that way and we still do the reintroduction. So the low FODMAP diet is quite flexible in that sense. It's not one size fits all. It's not for everyone. So if you have, you know, if restricted food is hard for you, if looking at certain foods that may cause you symptoms, give you a lot of anxiety, then don't do the low FODMAP diet. Yeah. Work on your relationship with food first.
Yeah. And for people who don't respond to low FODMAP, what are our options? What are the strategies?
Yeah, that's really tricky. Most people do respond to some extent, but there are some people who will still have persistent symptoms. That's when we really look at what symptoms they're experiencing and what tests are we missing? What tests do we need to do more of? And then this is also when we think about maybe doing a breath test for SIBO, or maybe think about gluten intolerance, because about 30-36% of IBS patients may potentially have non-celiac wheat sensitivity. And then that's when we may say, okay, well, let's not do low format to the extent that we're doing or not be so strict, but let's do this, which I hate to say because the gluten-free diet is so difficult. It's so hard. But for those people with a real gluten intolerance, they're going to see symptom improvement so much faster. And that's also when they remove gluten, that's when they would be able to introduce more of the FODMAPs.
I love that. And what's your perspective on fibers? What kind of fibers do you use in your practice? What do you find effective for people with IBS-D, IBS-C?
Yeah, so with IBS-C, I think psyllium is definitely the number one recommendation. But however, for people with IBS, I think a lot of the times we're also dealing with sensitive stomach. And we want a fiber that has maybe less friction, less roughages. And what I find is a partially hydrolyzed guar gum tends to be tolerated a lot better for most groups of IBS patients or for most everyone with IBS. So that's something I usually recommend as a supplement for people to use if they're not meeting their fiber goal while on a low FODMAP diet. We do emphasize a lot more on a real food diet, you know, as much as you can, you know, add one fruit to your meal a day. If you can't, you know, let's work on breakfast first. That's the meal that we can control the most, and then work on lunch and then dinner, or maybe work on lunch last. It's on days when they cannot meet their fiber goal on their own, then we would recommend maybe, you know, adding a smoothie with a little bit of soft fiber on your diet to help things move along better or to help solidify your stool more for those people with IBS-D. That's my take on fiber. And of course, there's chia, there's flax. Those are all great. But when it comes to sensitive tummies, it can be hard to just add 2 tablespoons of chia seeds into your smoothies or into what's that called? Internal shower.
Oh my God,
that people
yeah.
were doing the TikTok challenge. When I looked at that, I was like, wow, that's not going to work. But it may shock someone's system. And then if they're very constipated, they will run to the bathroom and just clean everything out. But no, don't do that to your gut. Go slow, but be consistent, right? So with fiber, that's what my recommendation is. Fiber works like a double-edged sword, right? Mm-hmm. It helps with constipation, with motility, but it also helps firm up stool when you have diarrhea. Pick the fiber that works for you. Still start slow. Even partially hydrolyzed guar gum is so well tolerated. We sometimes still start at maybe 1/2 teaspoon or 1 teaspoon to start for some patients with more sensitive guts because that's all they can tolerate. And it's helpful. Then let's keep doing that. And then maybe next week we go up to 1 tablespoon and see how well they tolerate it. We don't want to shock the system as always.
And you know, nutrition, I wish as a gut health dietitian, I wish I could say nutrition was 100% of everything, but you talked about things like stress, things like sleep. So in terms of people taking a more holistic approach to making sure, I mean, this is a gut brain issue. What other practitioners should people be talking to or lifestyle strategies should people be employing to make sure that they've got like all facets?
This is a loaded question. Let's break it down. I think another practitioner we want, well, actually two other ones that we want to incorporate into the team would be physical therapy, because a lot of the time the muscle tone of your pelvic floor can impact a lot on how you poop, the way you defecate, or how well stool is coming out. So that's really important. And then a clinical psychologist or a therapist that can help you implement more strategies to work on stress and sleep. I think as dietitian, we can teach some of the more basic things, right? But if somebody is really anxious about certain things, it will be outside of our scope. And it's best to bring on a therapist that can help the clients or the patients on that end. So on this end, I want to say, you know, for a good team to support a patient with IBS or any gut disorder, you need a GI, you need a good GI, maybe a good GP as well that knows your history, that you can see them sooner than you can see the GI if anything comes up. And then a dietitian to help you on the diet and lifestyle fronts, and a psychologist to help you if you're experiencing a lot of stress and anxiety. And we know people with IBS, the majority of them will have some sort of anxiety disorder because gut disorders are just debilitating. Yeah. Most people don't understand how debilitating it is. And it's really hard living with an invisible illness, right? People think that you are very healthy when in fact, there's so much going on in your head. So having a therapist or a clinical psychologist can be tremendously helpful on this front. And then last but not least, a pelvic floor therapist. If that's something, you know, your insurance would include or is something you can't have access to, because again, those are pelvic floor therapists who specializes on that area, they are not always available in all places. You know, if you have access to one, you know, get an assessment from them. Make sure your muscles are coordinating well. So really for anyone with gut disorders, you need a team approach. It's not just one size fits all. It's not just like, okay, you have a doctor and that's it, or you have a doctor and a dietitian and that's it. And really based on what symptoms you have, what may be contributing to your symptoms, and then deciding who else to include on your team. But I would say GI and dietitians are must, because we can probably test most of the things and we can really help you support the patient when it comes to food and lifestyle. And then if we see more red flags, that's when we bring on other specialties if we have to.
I think I need to invite a pelvic floor physio onto the podcast, because I don't think most people realize it even exists and what they can do. And particularly with constipation, the amount that the pelvic floor is involved is mind-boggling. So I'm gonna put that on the list for later. Okay.
Yeah.
We have learned so much from you, Jessie. I think this is the perfect time to switch into the rapid fire questions that we do every episode, little softballs to get to know more about you. So first one, sweet or salty?
Salty.
Your favorite meal when your tummy is off?
Oh, a big bowl of noodles with a semi-cooked eggs on top.
Nice. The best book you've read recently?
Oh my God. It's a book you recommended. Focus.
Do you love it?
Yes. Oh, Stolen Focus.
Stolen Focus, yeah.
I love it. Oh my God. We don't recognize it, right? How much our brain is saturated with information that we probably don't need and is causing a lot more anxiety and tension on our body. And that really triggers a lot of gut symptoms all the time and we don't think about it. But yes.
Everybody, every human needs to read this book, because our society is just not set up for our mental and physical well-being. And we need to be reminded of that. Okay. The next trip, I know you were just on a big trip, but the next trip on your bucket list.
Oh, this is for anybody who may be dietitians. We are, well, on my bucket list. Well, I was going to say I'm going to go to Fancy.
Oh,
and
me
I'll
too.
Be talking about poopedia.org. You are? Okay, we got to connect. I'll be with Botsign to talk about Poopedia. So hope to see you there and I'm sure we'll connect. But on my bucket list, I feel like our life is so... So much is going on with our life. I think if we can survive the next 2 months, that will be good. So we just came back from a long international trip, but seeing your parents is not checking anything off your bucket list. This is interesting because I've never been to Taiwan, even though I'm from Hong Kong, but we live in the US. So every time we do a big trip, we're going to see parents in where we are. So we don't get to travel very often. But Taiwan is somewhere I really want to go visit and eat all of the food in their night markets. Yes, it's always food oriented when I think about traveling.
Oh, yeah, me too. I can absolutely vouch for Taiwan, but I have not been there in 20 years. But so it's going to be completely different, but absolutely, it's beautiful and the food is incredible. Okay, last one. Three things you would take with you to a deserted island.
A mocha pot.
Nice.
To brew my coffee. can a mocha pot be full of coffee beans?
Sure. We're just going to include, them. That's going to be an all in one because you're a parent and you need it.
Right. A water bottle. Right.
Yeah. So healthy.
Right. I was going to say my phone, but then that just doesn't sound right because I can't charge it. I'll bring a pillow. I think sleep is so important for me. I need some form of ways to improve my sleep if possible.
Yeah. Sleep is the holy grail. I spent a decade not sleeping. And when I finally figured it out for myself, it was like, I am a new person. Sleep is the cheapest and most underrated form of like holistic self-care possible. Like it's just can't get enough of it.
Absolutely. And it's so hard to get enough of it. Well, that goes back to stolen focus. Yeah. Like, where did our attention go? Where did our time go, right? And something else I want to throw in here, if you have a sleep disorder, go to a sleep specialist. There are sleep specialized physicians. Don't just go to anyone. You want to go to someone who is a medical doctor who studies sleep. There's neurologists, there's psychologists, there is, psychiatrists in sleep medicine, but there's a lot of neurologists in sleep medicine. So improve your sleep. It's going to help you so much.
So much. That's perfect. Jessie, thank you so much for your time and for teaching us so much. I know that, IBS is always going to be a thing here on this podcast for very selfish reasons, but I know a lot of our community also have IBS and digestive issues, and they're always so eager to learn more. So thank you so much.
Desiree, thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
I love chatting with Jessie because she has a wealth of really useful information about living with IBS. I highly recommend you give her a follow at IBS.dietitian on both Instagram and TikTok. And if you love this episode, consider sharing it with someone you think needs to hear it. And be sure to hit that subscribe button so you don't miss a single episode of the pod. Until next time, friends, be well.